Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
Two retirees in the United States have found 10 apple varieties that many scientists thought had died out. The apples, once identified as lost, were among hundreds of fruits collected last autumn in Idaho and Washington state. The discovery represents the largest number ever found in a single season by a not-for-profit group called the Lost Apple Project. The group has just two members, E.J. Brandt and David Benscoter. The two learned about the results of their hard work from experts at the Temperate Orchard Conservancy in Oregon, where all the apples were sent for study. Brandt described the recent results as almost unbelievable. He added, "I don't know how we're going to keep up with that." Each autumn, Brandt and Benscoter spend many hours searching for old and often dying apple trees across the Pacific Northwest. The two travel by truck, all-terrain vehicle, and by foot. They collect hundreds of apples from fields where apple trees once grew. They find these orchards by using old maps, newspaper stories, and sales records. By connecting names from those records with property maps, Brandt and Benscoter can find where an apple orchard might have been. They often find a few trees still growing there. The two carefully note the placement of each tree using global positioning system technology. They then tie a piece of plastic around the trees, collect some apples, and ship them to the Oregon experts for identification. In the winter, the two men return to the trees, often in bad weather, to take wood cuttings. These cuttings can be put, or grafted, onto roots to make new trees. The work is difficult. North America once had 17,000 named varieties of apples, but only about 4,500 are known to exist today. The Lost Apple Project believes settlers planted a few hundred varieties of apple in the Pacific Northwest alone. With the 10 latest varieties identified, Brandt and Benscoter have rediscovered a total of 23 varieties. The latest finds include the Sarı Sinap, an ancient apple from Turkey, the streaked pippin, which may have grown in New York as early as 1744, and the buttersweet of Pennsylvania, a variety that was first noted in Illinois in 1901. Botanists from the Temperate Orchard Society compared the collected apples to watercolor images created by the U.S. Department of Agriculture in the 1800s and early 1900s. They also studied written descriptions in old botany books, some of them more than 150 years old. One apple, the Gold Ridge, was hard to identify because the experts could not find any paintings or descriptions of it anywhere. Finally, botanist Joni Cooper found it in a book written by a botanist who died in 1912. "It's the luck of the draw," said Sean Shepherd, another Temperate Orchard Conservancy botanist. And we learn more as we go along. With spring returning to the Pacific Northwest, the Lost Apple Project will soon enter its busy season. As they wait, Brant and Benscoter are busy grafting wood cuttings from the newly discovered lost apple trees onto rootstocks and updating their records from the last season. Their nonprofit group took a major hit when they had to cancel two events. An annual fair where they sell newly grafted lost apple trees and a class on how to graft wood to grow a new apple tree. The cancellations were due to the new coronavirus. I'm John Russell.
False information about the new coronavirus has continued to spread around the world, just like the illness itself. In answer, major technology companies have created new tools and rules to reduce misinformation and provide facts about the virus. Health officials and others have welcomed the new efforts. They have long urged tech companies to do more to prevent the spread of false information online. Andy Pattison is head of digital solutions for the World Health Organization. He told the Associated Press that some major tech companies have taken stronger action to reduce coronavirus misinformation. For the past 2 years, Pattison has been urging companies like Facebook to take more aggressive action against false information about vaccinations. Now, he says his team spends a lot of time identifying misleading coronavirus information online. Sometimes Pattison contacts officials at Facebook, Google, and YouTube to request that they remove such misinformation. In some cases, coronavirus misinformation has led to deadly results. Last month, Iranian media reported more than 300 people had died and 1,000 were sickened after eating methanol, a poisonous alcohol. Information about the substance being a possible cure for coronavirus had recently appeared on social media. In the American state of Arizona, a man died and his wife became seriously ill after taking chloroquine phosphate, a product that some people mistake for the anti-malaria drug chloroquine. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, says chloroquine phosphate is used to treat disease in fish kept at home. It is not meant to be taken by humans. Chloroquine has been used to treat malaria and some other conditions in humans. It is being studied as a possible treatment for COVID-19, the disease caused by the new coronavirus. U.S. President Donald Trump and some of his supporters have said they think chloroquine could be an effective treatment against the virus. Similar claims about chloroquine were widely publicized and shared on social media. However, health officials have warned that the drug has not been proven to be safe or effective in treating or preventing COVID-19. Twitter and Facebook decided to take steps to reduce the spread of information about such unproven treatments. Twitter removed a post by Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, that described hydroxychloroquine, which is related to chloroquine, as 100% effective against coronavirus. Twitter also removed a tweet from a Fox News broadcaster in which she said the drug had shown promising results. And in what may have been a first, Facebook removed information posted by Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro, who claimed hydroxychloroquine was working in every place to treat coronavirus. Twitter also removed a linked video. Facebook, Twitter, Google, and others have increased their use of machine learning tools to identify false information. They also have put in place new restrictions on publishing misinformation. Dipayan Ghosh is co-director of the Platform Accountability Project at the Harvard Kennedy School in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He told the Associated Press that technology companies have learned that the publication of misinformation about the coronavirus can have tragic results. They don't want to be held responsible in any way for perpetuating rumors that could lead directly to death, Ghosh said. For example, the Facebook-owned private messaging service WhatsApp has put a limit on the number of people users can forward messages to. WhatsApp hopes this helps limit the spread of COVID-19 misinformation. Facebook also recently announced that it would start warning users if they have reacted to or shared false or harmful claims about COVID-19. The company says it will start sending such warning messages in the coming weeks. The users will also be directed to a website where the WHO lists and debunks misinformation about the coronavirus. In addition to efforts to reduce false information, technology companies have noted they are widely publishing facts about the virus from trusted news sources and health officials. They are also making that information easy for users to find. The WHO's Andy Pattison praises those efforts too. More correct information can help reduce the level of misinformation, he said. People will fill the void out of fear, he added. I'm Brian Lynn.
People may have questions about the new coronavirus. Can it survive in cold weather? Can the virus be spread by mosquito bites? Is there a vaccine or medication that prevents it? Is there any medicine that cures it? The answer to all of these questions is no. But there are ways to protect yourself. Wash your hands. Cover your cough. Stay at home if you are sick or advised by local authorities. For more information, visit the following websites. The World Health Organization at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Embert. Ronald Reagan was finishing his second term. He was America's 40th president and one of the most popular. During his 8 years in office, many Americans did well financially. Many felt more secure about the future of the nation and the world. The possibility of nuclear war with the Soviet Union did not seem as great a threat as it had in the past. The Constitution limits presidents to 2 terms. So in 1988, the country prepared to elect a new chief executive. There were 3 main candidates for the Republican Party nomination. They were George Herbert Walker Bush, Bob Dole, and Pat Robertson. Bush had just served 8 years as Reagan's vice president. Dole was the top Republican in the Senate. Robertson was a conservative Christian who had his own television program. Ronald Reagan's popularity helped George Bush gain the Republican nomination. Neither Dole nor Robertson won enough votes in the primary election season to be a threat. Bush was nominated on the first vote at the party convention. The delegates accepted his choice for Vice President Senator Dan Quayle of Indiana. 8 candidates competed for the nomination of the Democratic Party. One of the candidates was Jesse Jackson, a black minister and political activist. He won about 25% of the delegates. He had also sought the nomination 4 years earlier. The Democrats chose Michael Dukakis, the governor of Massachusetts. His running mate was Senator Lloyd Benson of Texas. In public opinion surveys, Dukakis looked like a strong candidate after the party conventions. But then he began to lose popularity. Many observers said he had waited too long to launch a nationwide campaign. The candidates heavily attacked each other through campaign advertising on television. Dukakis came under attack from the Bush campaign, targeting his record as governor. Campaign ads said Dukakis had not been tough enough with criminals.
Bush and Dukakis on crime. Bush supports the death penalty for first-degree murderers. Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton, who murdered a boy in a robbery, stabbing him 19 times. Despite a life sentence, Horton received 10 weekend passes from prison. Horton fled, kidnapped a young couple, stabbing the man and repeatedly raping his girlfriend. Weekend prison passes. Dukakis on crime.
Ads by the Bush campaign also said Dukakis would weaken America's military power. And they accused him of not protecting the environment by seeking a permit to dump sewage from Massachusetts off the coast of New Jersey.
The Environmental Protection Agency called Boston Harbor one of the dirtiest harbors in America. But not long ago, Governor Dukakis proposed a way to help clean it up by dumping Massachusetts sewage sludge off the New Jersey shore, just 106 miles from New York. Now Michael Dukakis says he wants to do for America what he's done for Massachusetts. New Jersey can't afford to take that risk.
I'm fed up with it. Never seen anything like it in 25 years of public life.
Dukakis fought back.
George Bush's negative TV ads, distorting my record. Full of lies, and he knows it.
Dukakis accused Bush of not telling the truth about his part in the secret sales of arms to Iran to finance Contra rebels in Nicaragua. He also criticized Bush for being part of an administration that reduced social programs.
I must have been living through a different 8 years than the one the vice president's been living through, because this administration has cut and slashed and cut and slashed programs for children, for nutrition, for the kinds of things that can help these youngsters to live better lives. Has cut federal aid to education, has cut Pell Grants and loans to close the door to college opportunity on youngsters all over this country. And that, too, is a major difference between the vice president and me.
In the end, Bush's campaign succeeded in making Dukakis look weak on crime and defense. Dukakis did not help himself with a commercial in which he was looking out of a moving tank while wearing a large helmet. Many people made fun of the ad. On Election Day in November, Bush defeated Dukakis by almost 7 million votes. George Bush was sworn into office on January 20th, 1989.
No president, no government can teach us to remember what is best in what we are. But if the man you have chosen to lead this government can help make a difference, if he can celebrate the quieter, deeper successes that are made not of gold and silk, but of better hearts and finer souls, if he can do these things, then he must. We as a people have such a purpose today. It is to make kinder the face of the nation and gentler the face of the world. My friends, we have work to do.
George Bush was the son of a United States senator and had led a life of public service. He joined the Navy when America entered World War II. He flew attack planes. He was just 18 years old, at that time the youngest pilot the Navy ever had. He flew many bombing raids against the Japanese in the Pacific. He was shot down once and rescued by an American submarine. George Bush came home from the war as a hero. He became a university student and got married. He and his wife, Barbara, then moved to Texas, where he worked in the oil business. He ran for the United States Senate in 1964 and lost. 2 years later, he was elected to the House of Representatives. He ran for the Senate again in 1970 and lost again. But by that time, he had gained wider recognition. Over the next 8 years, he was appointed to a series of government positions. He was ambassador to the United Nations. He was chairman of the Republican National Committee. He was America's representative in China before the two countries had diplomatic relations. And he was head of the Central Intelligence Agency. In 1980, Bush ran against Ronald Reagan for the Republican nomination for president. Bush lost, but became Reagan's running mate. After two terms as vice president, he felt ready to lead the nation himself. The new president took 7 foreign trips during his first year in office. In Europe, Bush met with the other leaders of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. He proposed a major agreement on reducing troops and non-nuclear weapons in Europe. The Soviet Union considered his proposal an important step in the right direction. In June of 1989, the Chinese government sent tanks and troops to crush pro-democracy protests in Tiananmen Square in Beijing. Hundreds and perhaps thousands of demonstrators were killed. President Bush took some steps against China, but many critics felt the sanctions were not strong enough. In Central and Eastern Europe, communist governments also faced protests. Since 1987, Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev had let countries in the Warsaw Pact experiment with political and economic reforms. But those reforms were not enough to stop the fall of communist governments in one country after another. In the summer of 1989, President Bush visited Hungary and Poland. Both nations were trying to develop free market economies. Both were suffering as they moved away from central control. In Poland, the leader of the Solidarity Trade Union, Lech Wałęsa, led the push for reform. He would later become president of a democratic Poland.
Hier ist das erste deutsche Fernsehen mit der Tagesschau.
November of 1989 brought a dramatic expression of the changes taking place in Eastern Europe.
Guten Abend, meine Damen und Herren.
On November 9th, East Germany opened the wall that had divided it from the West since 1961.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight with Peter Jennings, reporting tonight from Berlin.
From the Berlin Wall specifically, take a look at them. They've been there since last night. They are here in the thousands. They are here in the tens of thousands. Occasionally they shout, Die Mauer muss weg, the wall must go. Thousands and thousands of West Germans come to make the point that the wall has suddenly become irrelevant. Something, as you can see, almost a party on. How do you measure such an astonishing moment in history? The East German government said tonight they were going to make more openings in the wall, at least a dozen more, put bulldozers right through the wall so that more people could cross to the West. The East German communist leadership tonight said there'd be a new election law guaranteeing secret elections which the rest of the world could monitor. And only 24 hours after East Germans were told they could go anywhere, anytime, the Soviet Union said that was a sensible move.
Within days, citizens and soldiers began tearing down the wall as the world watched with hope for a new era of peace.
Now, what's it feel like to be standing on top of the wall?
Incredible for me. I can't describe really my feelings. It's something unreal for me.
If there is someone who sleeps for 8 weeks and you told him what happened here, he thinks you're crazy. It's unthinkable. Put my number.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.